I'd like to call this meeting of the House Transportation Committee to order. It is 1:35 on Tuesday, March 3rd, here in room 124. Members present include Representative St. Clair, Representative Nelson, Representative Mina, Representative McCabe, Co-Chair Eichheit, and myself, Co-Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business, and please take this time to silence your cell phones. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Jordan Nicholson from House Records and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO for staffing our meeting today. Our committee aides are staff Griffin Sukeu from my office and Meredith Trainer from my co-chair's office. On today's agenda, we are hearing a presentation from the Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft System Integration, or AQUASI, on the future of innovation in Alaska. Presenting today will be Director Dr. Kathy Cahill. Very grateful to welcome Dr. Cahill to our committee today over Teams. And please put yourself on the record, and we can go ahead and start the presentation.
Thank you. Esteemed co-chairs and members of the House Transportation Committee, it is my pleasure to be here today. I am Kathy Cahill. I am the director of the Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration, also known as AQUASI. And I am here to kind of give you an update on some of the cool things that are happening to bring unmanned aircraft, also known as drones, into the national airspace system here in Alaska. Feel free to ask questions at any point, and we'll have questions and answers afterwards. So feel free to jump in whenever you want, and hopefully we can have a really good discussion about some of the neat things that are happening at the university. Next slide, please. So, for those of you who know us, this will be a refresher. For those of you who don't, this is a little bit of background. So, the Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration is the University of Alaska Center of Excellence for Unmanned Aircraft, also known as drones. And we started working with drones back in 2001, so we actually are some of the granddaddies in this field. The Board of Regents consolidated us into a center of excellence for the university in 2012 to compete for an FAA drone test site. We received that acknowledgement, and so we ended up being one of the original seven. Two more were just added in January, so there are now nine test sites in the United States. The other two added were Indiana and Choctaw of Oklahoma. So they added a state and a tribal organization to the group of test sites. Our goal, of course, next slide please, has been the safe integration of unmanned aircraft with traditional aircraft in the national airspace system. We're Alaskans. We are an aviation state. We are firm believers in that we need to be able to operate safely with all of the other airspace users. And we know we have a lot of folks who are flying general aviation aircraft that are not equipped with transponders. We need to make sure that we can determine where they are and avoid them so that a hazard is never created between manned and unmanned aircraft. Next slide, please. So this is who we are. We're a weird bunch. I like to tell people we run a military flight wing as a business in the university. We have a very experienced, very professional organization. And that way we operate as a military flight wing. We will go, we will get the mission done, it will be done safely, and it will be done professionally. And then we're going to be doing it to help advance economic reasons, and we have to move at the speed of the field, which is the speed of business. And even worse than that, this is a disruptive technology. This is something that is moving very, very quickly and far faster than the regulations can actually keep up. That makes my job a whole lot more interesting, but it's also giving me a lot more gray hair. So as we are doing this, we are moving at the speed of business, but we're also doing it inside a university where we're doing it for the public good. We are trying to make sure that we are training the next generations and that we are doing research that supports the state, whether it be helping to look at glaciers and their motion, to be able to do resource development, you know, look for weeds, invasive weeds in fields, all of these other types of missions that get enabled with this technology. Next slide, please. What makes our program different from everybody else in the country is that we have real-world use cases. We live in here in Alaska. We do not have Amazon dropping packages on our deck. You know, we have a last hundreds of miles problem, where a lot of the goods that are transported in the state are significantly delayed due to weather or to airport instrumentation outages. And so it is very possible in our rural communities to get cargo delivered that is both frozen and molded, which is a true achievement, but it is what happens here in Alaska. So we really have use cases that we care about and that can make a difference for people in the community. If somebody has a diabetic episode in a community served by Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, they will charter a plane to deliver a box of insulin. If we can manage to get it so that we can deliver that with an unmanned aircraft, we've taken a pilot out of the equation, so reduced risk, and potentially can save lives multiple ways. So we have things that we care about and things that we are really looking for as Alaskans. Second thing, we don't care what technology we use. We're agnostic. Just give me something that works. I want something that can fly at minus 40. I want something that is going to be able to fly long distances. I probably don't want battery power, because if I land in a community that doesn't have a lot of power generation, it's going to be very difficult to recharge that aircraft. So there are a lot of things that we're thinking about in terms of what technology is appropriate for our state. And it turns out it's also appropriate for the military. Remote cargo delivery to a community is the same as delivering something to a forward operating base. So we can support our military through the efforts we actually are doing in supporting the civilian aspects of our state. Flying beyond visual line of sight, VVLOS, of a pilot in command is a requirement for most of our use cases. This has been a major high tent pole that we really need to knock down. So this is something that is really keeping us from moving this forward quickly in the state of Alaska. We do not have the ability to follow an unmanned aircraft via car the whole way between Fort Yukon and Fairbanks, or between Dillingham and Bethel. So this is a case where we need to be able to, using technology and robust communications, be able to fly that drone beyond where the pilot is stationed without having to use, as we would right now, a chase plane or some other way of keeping eyes on the aircraft. Our military are actually having to chase gray eagles from the LAD Army airfield on Fort Wainwright to the restricted area where they can then be turned loose to do the work, because FAA does not trust any unmanned aircraft, especially a large one, to fly safely in the national airspace system. So we need to be able to remove that challenge, and so that gray eagle, which has thousands and thousands and thousands of flight hours on it, is incredibly reliable, has the ability to fly between those two areas without having a helicopter chase it at great expense and, of course, risk to the pilot. So that's just a small example. You know, anytime you're talking about doing anything in Alaska, you're going long distances. And given that only 82% of our communities are not reachable by road, as everybody in this committee knows, air is going to be one of the prime ways we go. So we need to be able to overcome this hurdle to really enhance the ability to do cargo deliveries, to do surveys of forests, moose counts, the whole works. We don't fly a highly instrumented box. A lot of the other test sites, they have a range. All they fly is on that range. We don't do that. We are the weird test site. If there is going to be an interesting project that requires you go fly someplace strange, Alaska will be involved. That's all there is to it. We are the ones who are willing to push that boundary and try to answer the more difficult questions by flying in areas that require we get special permissions every time we go. So we are constantly adapting to new areas, you know, flying maritime environments, you know, flying frozen, flying whatever it is in order to get that particular mission done. The other thing is we have a reach across the U.S. very few people know that we have. So we as a test site, when we were formed, We were the Pan Pacific UAS Test Range Complex. It was us, Oregon, and Hawaii. And when we won the test site competition, we assumed that the FAA would give each state its own authority. They didn't. They gave the authority, the oversight for safety, for every operation under the test site in those three states to the University of Alaska. So we started with kind of a distributed test site. Since then, we have expanded that. Now, why would we want to do that? Well, the answer is we want safe integration of unmanned aircraft in the national airspace system, right? Well, you need to be able to test them somewhere. And a lot of companies don't want to go far from where they're testing, and because they're going to be doing multiple repeats, they're going to be changing things. I mean, it is a real test and evaluation process. The other thing is Alaska is scary. So for us, it is a case of we are the final exam for most of these aircraft manufacturers. If they can't get it to fly in the lower 48, they are toast up here. We like to say we're the crusher of hopes and dreams. People say, oh yeah, I can fly at minus 40. And we say, come on up, fly with us. And they do. And then we have to teach them what they need to fix because it's not going to work on the first shot. So for us, having partners who can help with those preliminary stages of testing and then move it towards the final exam of Alaska is really helpful. And with a lot of our partners, these are commercial partners. So those 80 specific permissions at locations across the U.S. for advanced, more advanced operations, almost all of those are in association with some company. And a lot of them will be names you recognize. If you hear about air taxis, you hear about Joby. Joby works with us at one of those ranges. If you hear about WISC or Beta, they work with us at one of those ranges. Shield AI, Anduril, other names you've heard, they work with us at these ranges. So we are really helping move the entire unmanned aircraft slash drone industry forward in the United States by how we've positioned ourselves here. Next slide, please. The FAA has given us a lot of recognition. We are working projects under them with a bunch of commercial partners. We are one of the 9 test sites. We are now, it's up to 24 core universities in the FAA Center of Excellence. And we are one of the leaders in Beyond Phase 2, which is designed to help break that beyond visual line of sight challenge we have. We participate in the rulemaking committees and we fight for Alaskans in that. There was a whole discussion of right-of-way rules, and I'm very proud to say I came down on the side with AOPA and the Alaska Airmen's Association and others in terms of helping defend the right for general aviation pilots and others to fly under 500 feet and have the right-of-way. There is a rule making in process right now, Part 108, that would mean that unless your aircraft is electronically conspicuous under 500 feet, meaning you're broadcasting where you are, you have to give way to the drones. That is a complete change in right-of-way rules, and it is something I think will lead to accidents up here. Because we know where everybody likes to fly, under 500 feet and over rivers. So that's gonna put us in direct conflict with the drones that will not have to give way unless you happen to be transponder. If you have ADS-B, fine, they have to get out of your way, but if you do not, and most of our pilots do not have ADS-B, then you are responsible for giving way. We'll see when this comes out. The rulemaking had been closed. The comment period was closed. They reopened it specifically to look at the issues of right-of-way and electronic conspicuity because they are such an issue. And electronic conspicuity means that you are broadcasting where you are in some way or the other. Next slide, please.
And actually, Dr. Cahill, if we could go back to slide 6 there with the Venn diagram. Is there any other organization or entity besides Akwasi that falls into this middle bucket here that has all of these distinctions?
So up until recently, we were the only one. But Virginia Tech has managed to weasel its way into the FAA Center of Excellence for UAS Research. And so they are also now the Virginia Tech MAP program oversees all three. North Dakota, they are still in separate entities. So that one, they're not all under the same umbrella. So the only program that has all three besides us under one umbrella is Virginia Tech. So Tombo, who's the director there, and I are two unicorns of the unmanned aircraft world, where we are truly schizophrenic by having three cylinders of excellence overlapping.
Thank you for that. And I just wanted to note, I think it's really extraordinary how UAF is at the center of this discussion in a way that maybe a lot of folks outside of it and not having a knowledge of it wouldn't expect to have this distinction before, and now alongside Virginia Tech is very cool for us, and just thought I would draw attention to that. Representative McCabe also has a question.
Thanks. So, Doctor, I was up on the Bear Creek fire this summer, and they had drones up there, and I think you get into it a little bit in the further down in your slides. I get it, but they were using those drones for a different sort of technology, and I suspect that this would be, and you probably already know this, but this is going to be, because of the amount of wildfires and the number of wildfires we have in Alaska, this might be an avenue for you to sort of beat Virginia Tech, because I don't think they have too many forest fires in Virginia. Just saying, the technology as far as detecting hotspots, mostly watching over the crews that were going after the hotspots, to me was an amazing increase in safety. And I think you probably, like I say, you probably already know this, but I was encouraged to see that they were up there and working that fire so hard.
Well, Representative McCabe, you are absolutely right that this is going to be a technology that is going to help the wildfire fighter. Anything from dropping emergency goods, if they need to have a cell phone dropped in or water or an emergency blanket or any of those other things, that's going to be key, identifying where the fire is, how it's moving. We've done some of those operations ourselves, starting back with the Crazy Mountain Fire in 2009. So definitely something we're interested in. And later in the presentation, we touch on XPRIZE, which with their indestructible wildfire competition, we'll get into that more. But the purpose of that competition is to identify technologies that can detect an incipient wildfire and suppress it within 10 minutes in a 1,000-square-kilometer area. And we will be the finals. Alaska is the finals for that particular competition. It's an $11 million competition. So it's very important there. Another aspect of that, though, that we are also working is we are working counter drone on this. Unfortunately, fires attract drones and not the good ones. So on the Nanana Ridge Complex last year, people were flying drones and they were interfering with medevac operations. So we were able to leverage some assets we have under a Department of Justice project and actually go out and try to identify where the drone was and where the operator was so that law enforcement would have been able to track the operator down. Unfortunately, by the time we went through all of the agencies required to approve what we were doing, the drone and its operator were long gone. But we got to talk to FAA, DOJ, DHS, you name it, we talked to them to get the permissions to be able to go out and listen for where the drone and the operator were. So, yes, there are multiple different ways here to engage on wildfires, and Alaska really does need to be one of the leaders. So thank you.
Thanks. I couldn't agree with you more. I will tell you, however, if the chair doesn't mind, that, when the DOT brings a drone presentation to us, they bring us an example like the RoboDog. So I'm a little disappointed that the example's not right here.
Well, Representative McCabe, I would like to invite every single member of the Transportation Committee to come to a Quasi's Operations Center. It's in my district, so I'm very proud of it, and I'm very excited to share it with anybody, as is Dr. Cahill. It's actually attached to the airport. I don't know if we're going to talk about that, but it's on the East Ramp area of the airport. And so all of this work and student research is happening immediately adjacent to all of our other air operations in Fairbanks. It's very, very cool. But yeah, we can accommodate anybody who wants to come to Fairbanks. You can go ahead and continue, Dr. Cahill.
Thank you. And Coach Kirk, I do have to apologize. We actually gave up the Fairbanks hangar.
Oh, no.
But we have the 4,800 square foot hangar in Nana that we are doing the large aircraft operations out of. And everyone on the committee is welcome to come see the larger aircraft. Our largest now is a 32 foot wingspan, 900 pound maximum takeoff weight plane that you will see a picture of later in this presentation. We gave up the airport facility because we weren't using it, and what we were trying to do, we didn't want to interfere with Fairbanks International Airport operations, and we can trailer our aircraft to use them at Fairbanks as necessary. We still have everything up on the campus hill, though, so all of that is there. And then the Community and Technical College has a great hangar down on East Ramp as well that is very worth seeing.
Even better, Dr. Cahill, we'll come and visit, and then we'll take a road trip to Nenana.
You are welcome. Thank you. Okay, so the next slide shows really we are having an influence on FAA and its policy. So the Beyond program started as the integration pilot program put forward by President Trump during his first term. And it sunsetted at the end of 2 years, but the whole goal was to get unmanned aircraft into the national airspace system faster. And the FAA discovered that we had this challenge with beyond visual line of sight. So they actually, when that program sunsetted, asked the nine programs that were involved in that initial IPP to move into the Beyond program to keep working on this issue. So we did, but most of it was focused under 400 feet, which, you know, for us, you don't do long distances under 400 feet normally with unmanned aircraft. So for our missions, we wanted to go bigger, farther, and higher. And so we pushed the FAA. And now with Beyond Phase 2, in this picture, which is an FAA graphic, they have picked up bigger, farther, higher. So we have really set the agenda, and they are moving towards what we have been asking for, which are the things that will help with the Alaska case. Next slide, please. So on that front, you know, we have pipelines. So the picture in the back actually is the cover photo from the Integration Pilot Program final report. We won. We made the cover photo because we had done the first true beyond visual line of sight operations under that program over the Trans-Alaska Pipeline north of Fairbanks. So this is still an issue. How do you monitor the Trans-Alaska Pipeline system? Right now it's being done by manned helicopters at great risk. You've got challenges though in terms of doing it with drones because you're going long distances. The communications are poor. There's a reason Alyeska has its own radio system on the Dalton Highway. And you've got steep climbs. And in fact, that picture shows one of the steepest climbs in the entire Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which makes it very difficult to use most fixed-wing aircraft because they can't get that really steep climb. The permitting with the FAA and others is a real challenge, and it can be very expensive depending on which aircraft you're flying. So what we were looking for is how can you fly a relatively inexpensive, small fixed-wing drone that can fly close to the pipeline. If you can fly within 50 feet of the pipeline, it is considered a shielded operation. And then you don't actually have to worry about having detect and avoid onboard your aircraft because no manned aircraft should be within 50 feet of that pipeline. So that allows you a lot more flexibility, but you need to be able to maintain a safe distance above the pipeline. And that includes during those climbs. So you need to be able to climb quickly, and you're really looking at satellite command and control for the aircraft and for the data. So next slide, please. So we're in the process of acquiring two Griffin Aerospace RIP wings. They're also known as the MQM-186. Ignore that. We will never call it the MQM-186. It is a Red Wing. These are made in the United States by Griffin Aerospace in Madison, Alabama, and we have worked with them for years. That front picture on this presentation was our Sea Hunter, our 300-pound twin-engine unmanned aircraft. That is also a Griffin Aerospace aircraft. This has got about a 10-foot wingspan, a maximum takeoff weight of 54 pounds, and it's a gas engine, and to be honest, we helped tweak it. So next slide, please. So we worked with Griffin Aerospace and now have what we can call almost an incredibly overpowered aircraft. So we can do those climbs. It's gas powered, that gives us that longer endurance. And when we tweaked it, it was such a good product that the Navy said, we want those. And for some reason, we let the Navy have them first because we thought they needed them more than we did. But they are now being flown as a variant by the Navy because it is a really, really good aircraft. It's in kind of a sweet spot. We will be receiving our Red Wing aircraft in April, and the goal is to go fly the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System and look at the thermosiphon health in this fall. So we will be able to do long, continuous distances beyond visual line of sight using the shielded operation protections and be able to do this, we think, routinely over long distances. It saves people from having to drive the road in winter with infrared cameras where they can only do small, short sections. This will enable us to do large stretches that are otherwise very difficult to reach more easily. So moving forward on how do we do, among other things, wintertime infrastructure surveillance over long distances. We can apply it to roads, we can apply it to bridges, you name it, we can do it. Next slide, please. Since I last talked to you guys,
Dr. Cahill, if we could go back to that last slide, and we have a question from Co-Chair Eichheit.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, Dr. Cahill, so my only experience with unmanned space or flying devices, drones, is the really small ones that you see people fly as hobbies for photography and that. So are all these drones being flown by somebody, an active living person remotely, or are they like the autonomous vehicle, some of them like autonomous vehicle bill we just heard, where essentially it's a computer running it? If you could just clarify the range of technologies that are used to operate these devices.
So, Co-Chair, it depends on which aircraft you're talking about. The ones we are talking about here that Akwasi is flying, it is usually flown by computer, but we always have a human in the loop. There is always a human there monitoring the system, able to take over if anything potentially goes wrong. So basically, what you do is you fly what we call waypoints. So you pick what route you want to do, and you tell the aircraft to fly from here to here to here to here. If I suddenly, that last here needs to go left 500 feet, the pilot will move in and change that. Or if the engine is not behaving appropriately, the operator can take over and hand fly it to make sure that we know that we've got good control of whatever the aircraft is. Now, we are working with some teams to do fully autonomous, no human intervention operations. I will admit, I am not comfortable with a lot of those yet because we don't know. You have to have some way of, in my opinion, mitigating it if something starts to go wrong. And some of the companies working on that front are not quite as sensitive to that issue as I think people who are more aviation-minded are. The one aircraft that we have really worked with that is fully autonomous is actually Merlin's Cessna Grand Caravan. And that aircraft, when it flies with a safety pilot and a safety engineer on board, but they do not interact with the aircraft unless there is an issue. And that particular aircraft we flew in Alaska in 2023 and had Merlin pilot and Merlin engineer on board. They would taxi the aircraft to the end of the runway. The aircraft would take itself off, route itself around weather, obey air traffic control voice commands, and land with no human intervention. So that is kind of the future, but even with that autonomous aircraft, Merlin had a human monitoring. So even though a human was not doing any input, a human was making sure that the aircraft was doing what it was supposed to be doing, and they could have intervened if there was ever a problem. So right now, the way a quasi is working, you will always have a human in the loop with anything we are doing. The field is trying to move towards fully autonomous in a lot of these cases. But at this particular moment, you're not going to see a quasi doing anything where we do not have the ability to intervene and ensure the safety of the aviation and public.
Follow up. Yeah, thank you for that. That's fascinating. You know, the correlation with our autonomous vehicle bill was for commercial trucking, if you would, or delivery. And the idea is autonomous vehicles, of course, can have a track record of moving around pretty safely. But the bill would require a human caretaker, if you would, or operator on board to do exactly what you just said, to take over in that rare event where there was something where human intervention was needed. So I appreciate that. I just would ask, do you have a crystal ball that you can predict when we might have totally autonomous aircraft? How many years in the future? Any wild idea?
I would say that there are going to be some that are fully autonomous doing small cargo and other things, probably within the next 3 to 5 years. The larger ones, I think we are going to, it's going to be a longer period, but the Beyond Visual Line of Sight rulemaking committee that's going on right now has defined different levels of autonomy. And I know that Amazon and others are trying to actually meet those in the short term. And they are doing tests of that type of technology right now in the Dallas-Fort Worth and some other areas where they're flying under the Class C veil of Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport, which means everybody there is communicating, they're broadcasting where they are, which makes it much easier for the autonomous systems to know where they are and avoid them.
Thank you.
And Dr. Cahill, I have a kind of follow-up question to that line of inquiry. Do we currently have a definition in Alaska statute for unmanned aircraft?
Co-Chair Carrick, I'm not sure. I would need to go back and look. I don't remember. It's been a while since I've looked at the Alaska regulations. With the FAA, an unmanned aircraft is an aircraft. So,
okay.
I will need to go look.
Thanks. That might be something worth looking into. We have a few. We're laughing, Dr. Cahill, in the committee room because we have a few current areas of statute that don't have a definition for emergent technologies. And so we're joking, thinking about e-bikes and drones together. But I would be curious about the answer to that question. I think it's worth looking into. Thank you. Please go ahead.
To say, Coach Kirk, I can look into that and get back to you on it because now I'm curious. So, okay, next slide. So since I last updated the committee, we flew a Beyond Visual Line of Sight operation mission for Fury. So it was for a transporting an environmental water sample required by DEC to go from the natural gas rig to the shore, and they do this on a regular basis in order to make sure that they are compliant with the environmental regulations currently they are doing it flying somebody back and forth with either a manned helicopter or they're sending somebody via boat for a gallon of water. So in this particular case, this is what we call a no-brainer. It would be much easier to send an aircraft, a drone back and forth, have somebody load it on the other end and send it back. So the aircraft we used is the bottom right. That is a Super Volo. So Super Volo is one of our workhorses. We've flown it down at minus 26. We have used it as a counter drone, a drone detection target. We have carried all sorts of cameras. We test payloads with it. It is a workhorse for us. It's about a 6-foot wingspan, vertical takeoff and landing, meaning it's got propellers on it that lift it vertically off of a very small footprint. And when it reaches elevation, then it switches to a gas-powered engine that flies it like a fixed wing. So in this particular case, the distance was 15 miles. And if you look at the little map to the right, the part that was yellow is true beyond visual line of sight. It was only under radar coverage. There were no human eyes on the aircraft in that period. But the cone there was designed so that if anybody broke that cone, we had at least 4 minutes to get the aircraft out of their way. So in this particular case, we flew back and forth from the rig, picked up water samples, brought them back on the wings. And in this case, the FAA was concerned because they wanted us to do this as a Part 107, which is a low-level operation, so under 400 feet. They were concerned that we would hit a ship. So we full well know that if Super Volo hits a ship, the ship is winning. But they wanted to make sure that there was no damage done, nobody got injured, and that we didn't overfly anything we weren't supposed to. So we had to do streaming video. Streaming video at 400 feet in a maritime environment raises all sorts of challenges because the sea salt and other aspects of that really moist environment mean your RF signals do not transit well. This was the case. The biggest challenge was actually streaming the video. The aircraft did fine. It was happy with the command and control, etc. But it was a bit of a challenge on that streaming video aspect, which does tell you something about if we are going to be using it for maritime domain awareness or fishing, we're going to have some limitations in how far we can stream live video. So that is an important consideration for some of those fishing operations. But this was an example. It was successful, and we are working with Fury to turn it into a commercial enterprise where they would be able to do this routinely to really protect their employees and get those environmental samples that DEC requires in on a regular basis. Next slide, please. So I mentioned detect and avoid.
Dr. Cahill, if we could stay on this Fury mission slide. We have a question, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Quick question, Dr. Cahill. You, in this example that you just gave, you said that this has been done in the past by helicopter. And So the cost per hour of operating a helicopter varies somewhat. But as far as just since you said that Fury's interested in making this a commercial endeavor, what is the rough number, average cost per hour when you're running one of these Super Volos? Not necessarily versus a helicopter, because that could vary, but just the kind of cost per hour on one of these drones.
So Representative Nelson, it changes based on the size of the aircraft and how big that contingent was that you need to pilot it. Normally, you have one pilot and one observer. But when you're doing the beyond visual line of sight, we had observers on both ends. So those are the circles you see around either end. That is where a visual observer could see it. And the reality is you only really need one pilot for this. So it is a case where if you just happen to have a pipeline worker or somebody on the oil rig and somebody on the shore, you've got your visual observers and then it would be a pilot. So it would really be three people. And this whole mission could be done under a gallon and a half of gas. If you take the cost of the aircraft in Super Volo, I believe, is $35,000-$40,000, and do it over enough times, it doesn't take many helicopter hours. before you have paid for the system. And so in this particular case, it would be cheaper than using a manned helicopter in the long run.
Thank you. That was my assumption. I appreciate that. Thank you.
And I think we have no further questions now, so please continue.
All right. Next slide, please. So detect and avoid. This is the technology where we detect other aircraft in the air and autonomously avoid them. And it is really the holy grail for being able to fly long distances in the national airspace system. This is the FAA holy grail. If we can convince them we can do this, then we're going to be able to do a lot of the missions we're looking for. So we acquired two Wind Racers Ultra Mark 1 UAS. This aircraft is 900 pounds maximum takeoff weight, has a 200-pound payload, it's got three bay doors so we can drop parachute packages of medical supplies or cargo or something. And we're equipping it with a full radar-based detect and avoid. Next slide, please. So in terms of this detect and avoid, we are using Fordham Technologies R40 radars, and we are testing their ability to meet the industry standards for detect and avoid. Right now, numerous standards bodies are working on means of compliance, methods of performance, new standards to which detect and avoid systems must conform in order to preserve the safety and have the assurance that they will not miss identifying anything in the air that it needs to avoid. So if we can have this system actually meet those standards, that is the first step towards us being able to fly this aircraft with no chase planes and with no ground-based radar required to ensure the safety. That gets us towards doing these longer distance missions in Alaska. So this is a big step forward. This is not a trivial exercise, unfortunately. The Wind Racers aircraft are quite expensive, and the Fordham radars aren't exactly cheap either. But for breaking this for the state of Alaska, this is really, really important for what we are doing. So we are very, very excited about this. We've done our first test flights of the Wind Racers in Alaska. The integration with the Fordham radars will occur this summer, and then we are going to go ahead and work forward from that point as we proceed to do the flights, test the capabilities, and really see whether or not we are working to meet the standards that are being developed. So next slide, please.
And I think we're going to go back to that slide for 1 minute. We have a question from Co-Chair Eichheit.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, Dr. Cahill, you said the Wind Racer wasn't cheap. What's the going price?
Co-Chair, I'm sure the going price is about $750,000 a plane. Wow. And then you have the ground support system, trailers, et cetera, to go with it. So it is expensive, but it is as the size of aircraft that will be important in moving towards actual integration with real aircraft, the traditional manned aircraft, and it really makes the case that we can equip large cargo aircraft that we might be wanting to use in our state with this technology and have it be effective. So this is an expensive proof of principle, but if we can do it, we can unlock doing cargo longer distances in the state with things like Cessnas. So this, to me, is a very important step towards proving to the FAA that it can be done. Now, once you've done it in a pilot mechanism, of course, it gets cheaper. And the more aircraft that get tested, Wind Racers is selling more of these aircraft. We chose the Wind Racers aircraft because it is aluminum, which means we can repair it in Alaska. It has engines where we can get the parts in Alaska. In fact, Wind Racers now has a Mark II. They're like, oh, you want the Mark II? And we're like, no, actually, we don't want the Mark II. Is the Mark II has bespoke engines where we would not be able to get the parts if we were in the middle of nowhere. With these engines, we can hop in and go over to Home Depot and pick up what we need. So much, much better here. This aircraft had flown in Antarctica during summer, So it encountered cold for the first time in Fairbanks this winter. We were doing engine run-ups at minus 40, and the aircraft was behaving. And it had also landed on a Ministry of Defense carrier for the British, and then Royal Mail in the Hebrides and Orkney Islands. So it was handling maritime environment delivery mail. So this was definitely an aircraft we were interested in, and it is probably one of the biggest ones used by any university in the country. But again, we're leading the way.
Thank you, and we can go ahead and continue. We've pulled up the video link on the next slide. We can,
thank you.
We can go ahead and play that.
Maybe.
Maybe.
My name is John Robinson with the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Geophysical Institute of Quasi. We're at the Quasi Hangar at the Nenana Municipal Airport here in Nenana, Alaska. This morning we're going to go out and fly a approximately 900-pound UAV with a series of medical supplies in its cargo bay. We're going to parachute drop them here at Nenana Municipal Airport. Quasi is one of the FAA test sites. We collectively are charged with the safe integration of unmanned aircraft into the National Airspace System. These are our new aircraft from Wind Racers. This is the Ultra Mark 1. This is the coldest that they've ever actually done an operation at. There's some modifications that we've been working on with the company, but overall they performed well. We've been able to do some ground testing at 40 below, and then we've been obviously conducting flight operations here at 18 below zero. This test is significant because we are able to fly this aircraft in winter in Alaska in an unmanned aircraft system to be able to go out and do remote supply logistics. So when you couldn't normally send an aircraft, if the risk was too high, the UAV or drone has the ability to be able to go out and do these critical supply drops. Future for Quasi is very bright. This type of testing eventually will lead us to a situation where we'll be able to improve the conditions in the state of Alaska, as well as increase the safety case nationwide. Being able to do these types of tests, even on small scale, allows us to be able to eventually get to a point where unmanned aircraft and crewed aircraft can fly safely together.
Thank you. So that was done at minus 18 Fahrenheit. They'd been doing engine run-ups and touch-and-goes the week before. When we pull up the slide here, that right there is one of the things that was dropped there. So that is a rescue sled that the Army folds out of one of those boxes and can put a patient in to help keep them warm until they can be transferred. The parachutes were special Arctic hardened parachutes because normal parachute fabric will not survive at the temperatures we were doing the operations. So again, it's having to think through every step of being Alaska and flying in winter. The other packages included simulated blood, and another one included a defibrillator. So it was a check to make sure that you could do the drops, maintain the blood temperature, and have the blood rags not break, and get the equipment down and make sure that it landed undamaged. So this was a great success. We are really excited about it. And next slide, please. Excuse me. Diet Coke attack. So in terms of this, this is a picture showing that drop. And we are working with ICER, the UAA Institute for Social and Economic Research, and numerous tribal health organizations to really work at how can we use this technology to deliver medicines into communities under emergency conditions. You know, when the runway is destroyed or it's under smoke or something along those lines, or just in general, being able to deliver vaccines to the communities and have them administered in the communities. So this is something that we are very excited about. And it also highlights some of the work we're doing with our partner with ICER. So next slide, please. So this slide is from Mike Jones, Professor Mike Jones at ICER.
And Dr. Cahill, actually, if we could just stay on that previous slide for a second, we have a question from Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair to Dr. Cahill, I just passed a note to Co-Chair Carrick because I was thinking, wow, this would really put Balto out of a job 100 years ago. But it's really exciting the work that you're doing to help increase access to different to healthcare deliveries in rural. We had a hearing in Health and Social Services a few weeks ago about opportunities related to the Rural Health Transformation Program, and some of those ideas were related to utilizing drones to deliver medical supplies. So I'm curious about those partnerships with different regional healthcare providers. Are you also looking at applying for RHDP funds?
So to Representative Vina through the co-chair, yes, we are actually. In fact, the meeting I had right before this was with TCC, Channel Chiefs Conference, and their medical team. We're also working with the YK Native Health Consortium team. So we have outreached with numerous tribal health organizations. We have at least two where the tribal health organizations are requesting funding, and we are part of the proposal. In both cases, we are looking at those very initial planning grants because this is going to take a lot of planning and effort because you need to be concerned about things like chain of custody for medical supply. You need to make sure you've got safety regulations, hazmat, all of those other things taken care of so that you can do the deliveries safely and maintain the integrity of the samples, medications, and chain of custody. So it is definitely something that we are participating with. We are very excited about the potential, and we are looking forward to working with our partners and making this happen.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Next slide, please. Okay, so this slide is from Professor Mike Jones at ICER, and he has been doing an analysis with different tribal health organizations, and this is South Central Foundation data that is being shown. And here what he is showing is the shipping challenges in terms of community percentage of deliveries exceeding 7 days. And what it is showing is when you are far down the Aleutian chain or you're away from McGrath or some of the other hubs that you have significant delays in getting your medications. And so this is an opportunity for drones to be able to help shorten the time period for these patients to get their medications. Next slide, please. This is another part of Professor Jones's action, and this is really looking at what is happening with the aviation infrastructure outages, weather challenges, flight traffic. We have a lot of cases where the weather stations in a community are out, and it takes a long time for them to get repaired. We also have significant weather challenges. So the result is that we're getting the delays seen in those previous pictures. And as Professor Jones is proceeding with this particular operation, it is getting clearer and clearer that there is definitely some infrastructure needed here, but the drones will be able to fill, I think, a lot of these holes and work forward towards something that is actually efficient and can serve communities that right now get locked out due to aviation infrastructure outages or weather. Next slide, please.
And we're going to pause right on that slide, actually. We have a question from Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Dr. Cahill, on the map where it says ADS-B flight mapping Norton Sound, are those all medical supply flights that the green lines are representing?
Representative Nelson through the chair, co-chair, no, this is all flights.
Okay,
so
thank you.
This will fit in with the cargo as well, but the cargo right now, the cargo flights are where they're taking the medical supply delivery unless it is a specially chartered flight.
And Dr. Cahill, we also have a question from Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, Dr. Cahill, I'm just wondering, I was just kind of looking on your website to see if I could see without asking the question, but why don't you use more of the quadcopter type of thing? So instead of dropping medical supplies from an airplane, is it just the fuel and the range of the electrical of the batteries? Or I don't know. I'd kind of be interested to know that.
So, Representative McCabe, what we found is that the multicopters often don't have the endurance. The fixed wing, that lift given by the wings, really extends the endurance for an airplane. And we do have some gas-electric hybrid multicopters that have, 10-hour endurance. But usually what we have found and what the industry has really pushed towards is for long-distance flights, you are often looking at gas-powered. There are some electric ones, but almost all of the really long-distance operations, you are looking at fixed-wing.
Thanks. And so one follow-up, if you wouldn't mind, the Fury thing. Why Fury? I assume you're landing on a platform out there in Cook Inlet, so wouldn't the quadcopter be better for that? I mean, that's not quite... that you could probably do that pretty easy in an hour or two.
To the person who's controlling the slides, could you please go back to slide 11?
And we're there.
So, thank you. So, Representative McCabe, if you take a look at the aircraft on the bottom right, you see there's one propeller kind of in the middle. What you don't see well in this is there are four different electric motor propellers on those two long stanchions. And they have clicked into alignment so that they're streamlined. But that aircraft is a vertical takeoff and lander. So it does go up just like a quadcopter would. And then it flies horizontally to give you the fixed wing efficiency. Huh. And it recharges those electric propellers in flight so that when you come back to land, it has enough charge to be able to land them.
Wow, that's kind of interesting. I'd love to see that someday.
Well, you are welcome to Nenana and to Fairbanks at the University of Alaska. We have one of those in the office set up for people to see.
Awesome. Well, thanks. Since Nenana is much closer to my district than it is to Representative Carrick's district, I might take you up on that.
We'll invite the whole committee. It'll be a great outing. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick, through the co-chair to Dr. Cahill. On that, the weather challenges, flight traffic slide, going back to where we are at, is some of this data, could that be integrated with 511? I know that 511 has those cameras that are fixed at different highways in Anchorage and across the state, but wondering how drone technology can be integrated with that.
Representative through the chair, we use a lot of the aviation cameras in the passes and other things to determine what the flight conditions and the weather are. I don't know if it's been used in 511. I'm a firm believer in 511 for the road conditions in Fairbanks. But I think it would be a good thing to be able to use that. One of the issues with the FAA has always been the quality of the weather data. And the reality is the more sensors we have, I think the better. And I think we need to be able to go to some people's personal sensors in order to get a richer data set of what the actual weather conditions are, to be able to present where their challenges are, et cetera. So improving the weather data will be helpful, and I think that would kind of be able to create a little bit of a 511 for flying.
Cool, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Cahill, and I don't see any additional questions now, and it looks like we're on the slide labeled Skydio X10 Drone Docks.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. So Skydio X10 Drone Docks, this is a partnership with the State of Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, Caltrans, Skydio, and a host of other folks. This is through the Department of Transportation SOAR grant, and this part is the SMART grant. And really what these are these are basically nice little hangers that you can set out that can open, release a drone, and then that drone can be flown by a remote operator to go do a collection of data. For example, these were used after the storm in Western Alaska to be able to take a look and get imagery of the communities and be able to send it back to a command center. They could be flown by the folks in Anchorage, they could be flown by DOT folks in Juneau, but the whole goal is to really get that imagery up and going in locations. So they are testing a bunch of these drone docks across the state of Alaska, and we have the proud reputation for running the northernmost of them. And so next slide, please. So this is the drone dock at Fairbanks. You will notice ice dripping from the dock. So far, the drone dock has survived Fairbanks during our spectacular minus 48 degree snap and are nearly breaking a record for the number of most continuous days where the high did not clear minus 15. So far, we're doing pretty well on that. The dock has been able to open. The aircraft has been able to launch and fly. And so we are working to identify any snags. For example, we know that one of the cameras is not a fan of cold temperatures. So, you know, you change things out like that in order to make it work. The whole goal of these is emergency response, to be able to get eyes on really quickly. And the State Department of Transportation has done a very nice job with this. They have done times where for example, the Ketchikan landslide, they were able to remotely fly basically one of these systems and go get imagery of where people might be buried, what the extent of the landslide was, et cetera, without having to have an operator on site in Ketchikan at that moment. So these are a very valuable first response type system. And we often now are referring to what's called the DFR. A drone is a first responder. That you can remotely fly one of these and get some of that data that you need. Next slide, please. For university, we also do research. So this is a tower that some of the Aquasi scientists, in conjunction with some folks in Canada, put together. The tower is to the bottom right, and this is looking up top, looking down. That blue box creates droplets of a known size at whatever temperature you happen to be at, and that creates icing on drone surfaces. So you fly a drone inside basically this cloud that you've created of known droplets, and you develop ice on the propellers, which is the top right photo. And so this allows us to test anti-icing and de-icing technologies. And of course, anything we learn with small drones in terms of anti-icing, de-icing can be applied to manned aircraft as well. So this is a very, very important facility for us to have. We do have what we refer to as the drone crash button. If we set the conditions exactly right, we can crash a drone in 3 seconds. So this is definitely something that we want to make sure that we are working through. How do you survive in Alaska? And everything we need to do to be completely safe. So good scientific research in support of aviation. Next slide, please. We're also doing some interesting work on Arctic trafficability. We are looking at using synthetic aperture radar, LIDAR, and ground penetrating radar to really look at the best way to traverse snow-covered or melting permafrost environments. This also gets ice thickness, lake or sea ice thickness. So this is something that potentially, once we've got it really refined, we could use in remote communities to determine where the rivers are safe to cross or not safe to cross, because we would be able to get the thickness of the ice without having to go out and auger. So very exciting research here in terms of something that could potentially save a lot of lives. Next slide, please. All right, XPRIZE. So we're supporting the XPRIZE Indestructive Wildfire Competition. As I said, $11 million in this, two tracks. We're running the track B, which is the detection to suppression of a high-risk wildfire starting. within 10 minutes in a 1,000 square kilometer area. We have five finalist teams. Two of them are from other countries, three are US. One of them actually is a high school team that has actually done really well in other XPRIZE competitions. It's a sign of what a really good mentor can do. They will be coming up to Alaska, and I can tell you that, drum roll please, this will be done down near Nenana. So we will have a Distinguished Visitors Day. Please consider all of you yourselves invited. We will send information out so that you can come and meet the teams and get the dog and pony show. But to get to this point, this started with teams around the world. After much down selection, they got to the final 15. The Akwasi team visited every single one of those teams at their home stations and evaluated the technology and whether or not it had the potential to actually satisfy this. And we got down to the five final finalists. So it was many, many, many days on the road, especially for our deputy director. Shucks darn, I only had two. One was Southern California, ho-hum. The other was Tasmania. So this is proof I have a horrible life. We do have five teams, and we are pretty sure that some of these teams will be able to do this. Nice. So we will have a bunch of judges up and operating for that. So exciting research there.
And Dr. Cahill, consider us wanting that invite. We would love to come. I think the whole committee is very interested in that.
Yes, Judge.
Well, Co-Chair Carrick, so set aside some time in June, and we will have an invite out to all of you. Next slide, please. Okay, we're also doing something right now that is incredibly important given what is happening in the Middle East. We are working on counter-drone technology, and a lot of what we are doing is detect, track, identify. So spotting where the drone is and working through it. Now, the good news is with that, we managed to stay nice and clear of violating Title 18, Title 49, et cetera. That is our goal, stay completely legal while still being able to advance the research. So we are working with the FAA to determine what the effects of some of these drone detection systems potentially could be on first responder communications, or other systems critical to the safety of the national airspace system. You don't want to turn on something to detect adverse drones and accidentally jam somebody. With the Department of Justice, we've been working on the use of passive radio frequency drone detection systems to support local law enforcement agencies, including airport police. So we actually have drone detection systems right now at Fairbanks International Airport, at Ted Stevens International Airport, and other places to look at how many drones are interfering with the airspace. And the first time we put a sensor out near Ted Stevens International Airport, we caught somebody flying at 1,200 feet in the approach path to Ted Stevens. So this is a real issue, and it is something where we are working to get the Department of Transportation and the FAA and TSA to actually install these at Alaskan airports to help make sure that we protect the valuable assets that are the airports in Alaska. With Department of War, we are doing Red Force. This gets filed under I Have a Horrible Job. So we go out and we actually fly a wide variety of different aircraft against the base's defenses to identify if there are any gaps and how we fill them. So this is the university supporting our local military installations, and we're working with Eielson and Wainwright and Jay Bear and others. So this is definitely something where we're doing a major benefit to critical infrastructure here in Alaska. The other thing is that we are providing subject matter expertise on power UAS systems to the US Congress. I've testified to the House once in the Transportation Aviation Subcommittee and once in the Judiciary Prime Subcommittee on counter UAS authorities and how you actually operate these systems legally and how you kind of move the ball forward in terms of what needs to be done to protect things like the Olympics, the FIFA World Cup, Trans-Alaska Pipeline, Port of Valdez, other really kind of important assets. So next slide, please.
And we actually have a question on that side, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair to Dr. Cahill, I know that you mentioned earlier that Akwasi is FAA recognized in a lot of different areas. And so are there other similar institutions that help with assisting with like military testing, like Akwasi with the Department of Defense, or are you one of the only institutions doing that?
So Representative Mina, through the chair, a co-chair, the reality is everybody wants to do counter-drone. Most people do not have the capability to do counter-drone. So we, as one of the nine test sites, actually have statutory authority to be able to buy covered systems, translation Chinese systems like DJI, specifically for the purpose of testing counter-drone systems. It is written into the Code of Federal Regulations that we can support counter-drone testing. So all the nine test sites, of course, are jockeying for this. There are some other centers of excellence for DHS and others who are doing some of this counter-drone testing. And the reality is there are a whole lot of folks who are doing it illegally. And you talk to them and they're like, what do you mean I can't shoot down my own aircraft? Well, if you've read the statutes, you can't shoot down your own aircraft as much as we may want to. So there are a lot of folks who are operating in the area, but they are not necessarily obeying the laws on this. The other thing on this is, in terms of military testing, I didn't put a lot into the presentation, just because presentations tend to grab legs more than transcripts do. We are supporting the military in other ways too. The university has a university-affiliated research center with it. It just moved over to NORAD NORTHCOM, and so the university will be conducting research that supports military operations. So, you know, testing policies and procedures for doing over-the-horizon radar, or being able to test counter-drone type activities, or helping Fort Wainwright with 3D printing small attritable systems, which is something they're looking for. How can they get more unmanned aircraft into their possession? So we are assisting on that military front. We are not the only university doing this. This is something that people across the country are working on, especially trying to do those 3D small attritable aircraft. And it's something where right now grant funding is tight. This is an area where there is significant money. There is a major push inside the Department of War and several executive orders from the president really moving this forward as a major issue and something that needs to be addressed. So as you know, where the money is, people follow. Now, I like to say we've been doing this for years, working with Fort Wainwright and others, so we are not the Johnny-come-latelys, but we are definitely helping on some of these fronts.
Good to know. Thank you.
And we have another question, Representative McCabe.
So thanks. So, Doctor, based on news in the last 3 days, I'm wondering how, you know, if you guys have been consulted or if you're working at all with the DOW on those Shahed 136 drones that they're using over in the desert right now.
So, Representative McCabe, through the co-chair, we actually had a system, the one that we flew for the first time at Fairbanks International Airport. It sounds like a Shahed. So we actually had a counter drone provider who does acoustics actually come out and take measurements of what our aircraft sounded like to put it in their library to be able to separate it out from other background acoustic noise. And we fly what are called Group 3, so larger than those smaller ones, the quadcopters you normally see. And we provide those as targets. We will not let them shoot our Group 3s unless they cross our palms with a whole lot of money. But in terms of flying and giving them something to detect that is not the normal small drone, it's a drone more equivalent to what a state actor would have. You know, most people can't afford a Wind Racers, but Wind Racers has been used as an attack aircraft by other folks. So by the fact that we can work with that, we can use that to help people test some of those technologies. So in terms of a Shahed directly, no, but in terms of Shahed surrogates and things along those lines, yes.
I think we have a follow-up too.
Yeah, thanks. So the follow-up would be, you know, obviously over in the desert, we can just shoot the Shaheds down, but your technology, I assume, involves more, or for intervention, it involves more the like radio interference, or is it strictly mechanical?
So, Representative, through the co-chair, we cannot legally shoot down a drone. We can provide targets, and we can do a drone detection, tracking, and identification. The moment we press a button to take a drone down, I go to jail. And I'm really not a fan of that concept. So, but our partners who are military can. So in some cases, they will bring in a potential drone mitigation, as we call it, system, a counter UAS. And we will fly an aircraft that is meant to be destroyed and see if we can defeat that particular counter drone system. And they have permission to do all sorts of fun things depending on the system. So in terms of counter drone, what you commonly see in the field are, yes, the radio frequency jamming you referred to, hacking, spoofing. And so those are considered fairly soft because you're not actually damaging the aircraft. And then you get into more fun things like lasers, like what shut down the El Paso airport. And kinetic kill, where you hit a drone with a different drone or with a gun or something along those lines. They're high-powered microwaves. There are a whole variety of different systems. And as much as I want to have one, right now the federal government will not let me have one.
Thanks. That's fascinating. And actually, you know, if you're really upset with the quality of your job, I'm happy to trade.
You don't have to actually respond.
Representative through the chair. No.
It sounds fascinating. It really does.
Please continue. I think we're on CUAS highlights. And we, just for a time check, we have about 8 minutes left, so I think we'll go through these next couple slides, and then if we have time for last couple questions, we will.
Okay. So in terms of the CUAS highlights, these are some of the things where we were doing that drone detection and other things, and we had successes. First off, in terms of the flying Red Force, that means we are flying adversary testing systems. We have done several of those against local Alaskan facilities, and those were successes. We're really pleased with how the campaigns went, and I think our partners were excited about what we discovered. We also did deploy one of those DTI systems, Detect Track Identify, under the DOJ project for the Alaska Department of Transportation to do glacial outburst flood monitoring. We were able to spot an unmanned aircraft violate the temporary flight restriction, translation fly where they weren't supposed to, and it missed a DOT drone, it looks like by about 30 meters. We were able to track the drone and also determine where the hand controller was. So local law enforcement was able to go boots on the ground and go find the guy, which was awesome. And then University of Alaska Anchorage Police Department asked us to put up one of these systems during the President Trump, President Putin summit. And we were able to spot a drone violate another temporary flight restriction by flying over the UAA area where the delegates were housed. So these are areas where we were asked to come help and we were able to help. Next slide, please. So in terms of where we are really looking at what can we do to move things forward. We are working with airports, we're working with the military, we're working with commercial partners, tribal health consortiums, and numerous people to really see how we can implement this technology safely for the good of Alaskans. And that really is the take-home message, is we know we've got an amazing potential here to do good things, and we want to make sure it is the good things and not the adverse things that tend to happen. So with that, next slide. You know, they started with the fact we were looking for innovation. We do think we are flying north to the future. It is an exciting time to be in this, and I welcome any questions. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Dr. Cahill. We have a question, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, Dr. Cahill, it's really incredible hearing about the work that you're doing to help with disaster relief, and especially with fire suppression, glacial outbursts. With Typhoon Halong, I'm curious if there's any work that might be related to hurricanes and what we're seeing in the western region of the state.
So, Representative Mina, through the co-chair, yes, the Skydio dry docks, drone docks, were used during the Halong response. So that is a sign right there. The other thing is, of course, we had one community where the runway was damaged. Being able to send in cargo and do the drops like we were with Wind Racers, we could get some emergency response things in, supplies into those communities. So if there's a storm in the future, we would be able to do that. We are excited about, of course, being able to do the aftermath surveys quickly, so you can identify where people need help and be able to get the right assets there as quickly as possible. So yes, in terms of storm response, earthquake response, all of those other things, having drones available and having them available across the state, whether or not it's a drone dock or it's you calling us at the university or calling somebody in the Department of Natural Resources and saying, do you have a drone, can you put it up? There are a lot of drones, civilian and public, that can be used in case of one of these emergencies. And we just need to leverage it.
Awesome. Cool. Thank you.
We have another question. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair, Dr. Cahill, one thing that's been amazing to me is the rapid proliferation in the Ukraine war of drones that are essentially being ran by wire. And in your experience, when you're talking about like these counter UAS projects that you've been working on, or even when you've actually been on the ground, what can you speak to how you handle dealing with drones like that, which we don't see a whole lot here yet, but yeah, drones of that nature that are not commanded by radio, but by fiber optics.
So Representative Nelson, through the co-chair, the answer is yes. Those fiber optic drones are a challenge. That is why whatever is going to be a truly effective drone detection system needs to be layered. Because if it's not emitting RF, it is still emitting acoustic. So you can hear it. A camera could see it. So there are other ways of detecting it if you're not just doing that straight radio frequency where it's quiet. The other thing is the Ukrainians are incredibly creative. And what they've discovered is that barbed wire fences that spin will catch one of those fiber optic cables and break it. So there are some ways to be able to do some really low cost methods for defending against some of those fiber optic ones.
Thank you.
Last question from Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, Dr. Cahill, what, you know, I think earlier slide said you had 18 folks working with you. What's your annual budget?
Co-Chair Eichler, through the Co-Chair, right now it varies because of how the grants come and go. We are often running about a $10 million budget at the moment, but it does vary. And so it's multiple different pots of money, and most of them are usually spread out over multiple years.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions from the committee, thank you very much for presenting today, Dr. Cahill. Thank you for your work at UAF and with all of the partners that Akwasi works with. We really appreciate you presenting. Our next House Transportation Committee meeting will continue this discussion on technology. On Thursday, March 5th at 1 p.m., we'll hear from the Department of Transportation about technology and the future of innovation. And I'm sure they'll have a lot of really great dovetails into this presentation today, as well as a lot of additional technologies to talk to us about. With nothing further before the committee today, we are adjourned at 3 p.m.